Dr. Mehmet Oz visits Ohio this week as Governor Mike DeWine faces ongoing criticism related to alleged Medicaid fraud in the state. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, Dr. Oz's take on the concerns Republicans are raising. Plus, could this be the year Hamilton County gets millions to cap Fort Washington Way? Then the arrest of a former CMHA property manager accused of pocketing rent checks, and the city of Cincinnati faces a projected deficit of nearly $30 million. How the city manager wants to balance the budget. Joining me now to get the news review started are Cincinnati Inquirer state government reporter Haley B. Miller and Signal Ohio state government and politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Welcome back, Haley and Andrew.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
I was waiting for Haley. Happy Friday, everyone.
Yes. Haley, why was Dr. Oz in Ohio this week? Was this in response at all to concerns about this alleged Medicaid fraud in Ohio?
Not officially. The official reason was because Dr. Oz participated in an event with the governor related to what's called the Ohio Seed Program. It's an initiative very dear to DeWine that connects children with free eyeglasses and eye exams. So they met at a suburban Columbus elementary school, got some kids' glasses, and then answered a bunch of questions from us about Medicaid.
There you go. Well, Andrew, remind us why Medicaid fraud's become such a hot topic in Ohio over these last few weeks.
Yeah, there's a broader context. It kind of actually emanates back to a Medicaid fraud scandal in Minnesota involving childcare. But from there, it's the Daily Wire, which is a conservative website, did a series of articles about home health care in Ohio funded by Medicaid and raised questions about weaknesses in verifying whether the providers maybe should be approved to bill Medicaid, whether Ohio's safeguards are sufficient to screen out for fraud, and basically just raised questions about whether there's fraud kind of systemically in this particular part of Ohio's Medicaid program. That story got a lot of traction with Republicans and ultimately led to that being a pretty interesting backdrop for Dr. Oz when he came here this week.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, tell us more about this focus on home health care. What did the Daily Wire articles find? Is Ohio unique in the way the state funds those services?
So I'll take the second part first because it's really short. The answer is no. Pretty much every state funds these services in this manner. These home health services are generally not necessarily medical care, but kind of medical adjacent care that's provided to people at home, often the elderly, for whom staying at home is more appealing than living in a nursing home or something like that. And for the state, it's also much cheaper. But when you're talking about services that are provided in people's home, there's just inherently less oversight than there would be if, you know, these things were being provided in, again, say a nursing home or something like that. And so the series of articles did seem to, you know, more specifically highlight how there's a disproportionate number of Medicaid claims coming out of the Columbus area for these types of services, found some instances of kind of like, you know, again, this is another outlet's reporting, but providers that had questionable backgrounds and stuff like that. And the real question is, to what degree is this a systemic issue in the program? Because fraud is just kind of like a baked in concern about any large healthcare system. This is true in, you know, the private sector as well as in the public sector. The Medicaid program is just very, very large. And also, obviously, it's run by the state of Ohio.
Haley, what did Dr. Oz say about the way Governor DeWine's addressing these allegations? And did he talk about home healthcare services specifically?
Yeah, his biggest concern about home health care is, to Andrew's point, there's less oversight. And we know in some cases, home health care services are provided to people by their relatives. And, you know, Dr. Oz said, does the government need to be paying money for all sons and grandkids to be carrying in their grandparents' groceries? He said he feels like that there needs to be a clear need demonstrated for these services to be used and to be funded by the government. But Oz said that Ohio and Governor DeWine have been good partners in addressing this issue. He said he trusts DeWine to handle this, which is a stark contrast to what we have heard from state lawmakers in Ohio. They feel like DeWine has sort of derailed efforts to regulate this or not address the issue sufficiently. So it was interesting to hear Oz say that. We've also heard Vice President J.D. Vance say that Ohio has been a good partner in taking this seriously. So very different views about DeWine being portrayed from state and federal Republicans.
Well, Haley, we talked last week about the plan that Republican gubernatorial candidate Vivek Ramaswamy has floated to address fraud in Medicaid. Can you just refresh our memories about the highlights of that plan?
Yeah, he wants to change how much savings Ohio gets from the Medicaid program. He also wants to increase prosecution of fraud and just streamline things. He said efficiencies will, you know, make the program better all around. And Ramaswamy actually did meet with Dr. Oz when Oz was in Ohio. You know, both Oz and DeWine were asked about Ramaswamy's proposals. And, you know, they both said it's interesting, basically, but he's not governor yet. So it does sound like Ramaswamy is at least getting in the ear of federal officials about this while he's still on the campaign trail.
Well, Andrew, talk to us a little bit more about this meeting between Oz and Vivek Ramaswamy. Was it all about this pull-up competition?
Well, that was the part they posted on social media. And, you know, I was curious about what constitutes a chin-up versus a pull-up. But
see,
anyway,
it's those important follow-up questions that we count on you for, Andrew.
Yeah, well, but they didn't say a whole lot about this, but what we can surmise both from what Ramaswamy and Dr. Oz said about it, they did discuss Ramaswamy's plan. And when Dr. Oz was asked about, because basically the federal government would have to approve a major portion of Ramaswamy's plan, which, as Haley mentioned, involves allowing Ohio to keep a larger share of any fraudulent billing that they were able to recoup. And Dr. Oz was pretty noncommittal about that. He said that Ramaswamy is somebody that he's known for a long time, that he has a lot of innovative ideas, but he said that the devil is in the details. And so, for instance, Ramaswamy has said, without offering a lot of specificity, that he would like to, in addition to keeping the larger share of the money, potentially return it directly to Ohioans, use it to fund some kind of, you know, like copay assistance is kind of what he alluded to, but again, don't have a lot of details on that. And just thought it was kind of interesting that Oz didn't commit one way or the other to the idea.
Andrew, is there anything else you want to add about how or if Governor DeWine reacted or has reacted to what Ramaswamy is proposing?
Yeah, I mean, we asked the governor about it too, and he said it's an intriguing idea, but I mean, his response is maybe four or five words. So I'm not sure if he appreciates the backseat driving, but it's interesting that what he's largely done in response to this criticism is highlight how so the governor's office and the attorney general's office in Ohio's government have the largest responsibility for enforcing and detecting Medicaid fraud. And DeWine has held both of those jobs. So he's basically been, you know, a key figure in fighting fraud since 2011 in Ohio. And he said that, you know, the state's anti-fraud unit has gotten a lot of national recognition. They've done all this stuff to kind of detect fraud and kind of claw it back. So he said that the state has done a great job at this. And, you know, he, I'm sure, doesn't love all the criticism that he's receiving over it. But I did think it was notable that because we've seen the Trump administration make an example out of some states, Democratic run, but still states that have face questions about Medicaid fraud. And so I thought it was significant that as Dr. Oz came here, that he seemed to say that that Governor DeWine was doing a good job.
Yeah. Haley, Dr. Amy Acton, of course, is the Democratic candidate for governor. Has she responded much to all of this?
Her primary line has been that if there is rampant fraud in the Medicaid program, that it's on Republicans because Republicans have controlled state government, certainly since DeWine has been governor and even before that. So that's most of what we've heard from her, and that's not the first time we've heard her make that argument about different issues. It's honestly a hallmark of her campaign to point out that if Ohioans are not happy with certain aspects of government, whether it's Medicaid or something else, you know, the buck stops with the Republicans who have been in charge for a while.
Well, Andrew, you just mentioned the attorney general and that office's role in fighting fraud. Attorney General Dave Yost is stepping down June 7th. Where is he going?
He's taking a new job with a national public interest law kind of advocacy organization. I am blanking on what the name of it is at this moment, so I imagine somebody can jump in and provide the name for me. But
Alliance Defending Freedom.
There you go. And Yost was set to leave office at the end of the year due to term limits. And he had tried to run for governor, kind of anticipating that the time was running out for him in public office, and was unsuccessful. As we've talked about, Vivek Ramaswamy ended up getting the nomination. But yeah, so Yost is hanging it up early in his term, and he's going to go, I guess, you know, go to the private sector and get involved with this organization is involved with basically religious and social conservative advocacy in the legal system.
Haley, I know you talked with him in sort of an exit interview. And as Andrew mentioned, he began a run for governor, but Dave Yost told you that he had a trifecta working against him. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, so very quickly after Ramaswamy announced his campaign for governor, President Donald Trump endorsed him. So that was number one in the trifecta. And that led to the domino effect of the Ohio Republican Party making a very early endorsement in the race for Ramaswamy. And then Yost also pointed out that Ramaswamy is very wealthy and has the ability to put a lot of money into his campaign if he chooses. We've already seen him put some of his own money into the campaign so far. So, you know, Yost said when facing those three things, he realized it was just not going to be viable for him to continue. And I think the nail in the coffin really was that Ohio Republican Party endorsement. He and Governor DeWine tried to keep the party from endorsing so early in the race, but that obviously didn't work.
Is Dave Yost supporting Vivek Ramaswamy now, Haley?
He is, yeah. You know, he said that they have a lot of similar ideas and just different ways of approaching them. But, you know, Dave Yost is a Republican. He's going to support the Republican nominee for governor. And, you know, he had really advocated before he dropped out for a robust primary for Republicans so the candidates could kind of air out their ideas. And I asked him if he thought Republicans missed out on that opportunity. And he was like, well, we'll find out in November.
Well, Haley, tell us a little bit more about this new job, where he's going and what he'll be doing.
Yeah, so I can't remember his exact title, but it seems like he'll be playing a pretty prominent role with this organization. As Andrew noted, they deal with a lot of social conservative issues. They were instrumental in the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. So they lobby against abortion access. They have also defended, for example, wedding cake bakers who didn't want to provide services to LGBTQ couples. So because of cases like that, critics have pointed out that, you know, they feel like this organization is anti-LGBTQ. Yost rebuffed that a little bit, but, you know, those are the kinds of cases that this group has been involved in, and it mirrors a lot of the work that Yost has done for Ohio. I mean, he's defended abortion restrictions in Ohio. He has defended laws banning transgender affirming care, things like that. So,
Andrew, Dave Yost has been an elected office in Ohio for, I think, what, 25 years, something like that. What do you think his legacy as an elected official is going to be?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think something that he's done a lot, like in office. A big one is that he was an early critic of Jobs Ohio, which is the state's economic development private nonprofit arm. Former Governor John Kasich set it up back in around 2011. And Yost was kind of the lone high profile Republican to fight him over what I guess you could describe as transparency issues. That Jobs Ohio was created specifically to be exempt from state public records law. The idea at the time was that it would allow for them to do the kinds of business negotiations that maybe a business would be more wary about playing out publicly, and so they could shield certain things from the public. And we've seen recently questions get raised about how Jobs Ohio spent money on a podcast that was associated with somebody who the Ohio State University president with whom OSU's investigation after they fired the president basically said they had an inappropriate relationship with. So we've seen Yost kind of his concerns play out like that. I think another big thing that Yost's tenure kind of highlights, though, you know, the term attorney general or AG, there's a joke that it stands for almost governor. And you might think that Yost, by kind of following the trajectory that he did, would be set up well to run for governor someday. And we've seen in Ohio, the last three high profile state elections, it's two U.S. senators, J.D. Vance and Bernie Moreno, and now Vivek Ramaswamy, all Republican nominees with no significant past political experience, basically winning their party's nomination and in two cases winning office after getting endorsed by Donald Trump. So there's this traditional playbook about how you kind of work your way up, you know, you pay your dues, you hold a local office, and then you get elected to a state office and so forth. That kind of got upended by this current era that we're in, where Donald Trump can basically endorse somebody and help elevate them and put them into these high profile offices. And there's a little bit more to it than that. I mean, it's not like Donald Trump is just endorsing random people, but at the same time, you know, it's just works very differently than it used to. And I think Dave Yost's kind of trajectory helps illustrate that.
Haley, what did Dave Yost say about how the political landscape has changed since he first entered political office? I mean, 25 years is a long time. What did he say about how it's different?
He feels like there's a lot more what he referred to as manufactured rage in politics on social media related to political issues. He described it to me as, you know, people increasingly feel like they have to be at war over everything all the time instead of choosing their battles. And he doesn't think that's particularly productive. And I'm sure, you know, we could all have a debate about how much meaner politics has become in recent years. But that was his key takeaway when I asked him if he feels like, you know, Ohio government and politics is in a good place today. You know, he's in the work he's doing, I suspect he's not going to be completely tuned out of the political sphere, because a lot of what the Alliance Defending Freedom gets involved in are inherently political issues, but he'll just be coming at it from a different angle.
Yeah. Well, Haley, I have another political kind of thing I want to ask you about, and that's AI-generated content. How is that kind of changing the game with political ads?
Yeah, we're starting to see a lot more of it, including in Ohio. The Ohio Republican Party is experimenting with it a lot. We've also seen an anti-Sherrod Brown ad that appeared to be made with AI. And this has been happening for a while. Like, AI isn't necessarily a brand new thing, but generative AI is really having a moment, as I think we've all probably experienced personally. And it's very easy for anyone now to generate photos, audio, video that is not real. And so campaigns are using this in advertising. You know, they say that it's a way to find efficiencies, save money, that kind of thing. But there are real concerns from people who are watching this and, you know, wonder if it's going to contribute to the misinformation problem we frankly already have on social media.
Yeah. Does Ohio have any regulations around using AI or this technology, Haley?
Not yet. There's actually a fair amount of legislation out there dealing with AI in some form or another. One bill in particular would require disclosures on political ads if they use AI. This is something that we've seen a lot of other states do, and it's pretty much the furthest any state has gone when it comes to AI regulations for political speech, because a lot of lawmakers, including in Ohio, are wary of running into First Amendment issues. I mean, there's a lot that, you know, it's legal essentially to lie on air right now as it is. So there are limitations in what you can do with AI, but lawmakers here and in other places see these disclosures as one way to at least offer voters some transparency.
Okay, well, I know you'll continue to follow all that. I've been talking with Signal Ohio state government and politics reporter Andrew Tobias and Cincinnati Inquirer state government reporter Haley B. Miller. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, could the city finally bridge the physical gap between downtown and the banks? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. In the spirit of the old saying, if at first you don't succeed, Hamilton County is trying again for a federal grant to help cap part of Fort Washington Way. Joining me now to explain all this is Cincinnati Inquirer, real estate enterprise reporter, Sydney Franklin. Welcome back, Sydney.
Thank you, Lucy.
Always great to have you here. I'm pretty sure, Sydney, the first time I heard about the idea of Cincinnati and Hamilton County leaders talking about capping Fort Washington Way was like more than 20 years ago.
Right.
I mean, this has been going on a long time, or at least the talk has.
It has.
Explain what they want to do.
Right. So Fort Washington Way was actually, it's a sunken highway between downtown and the banks, 71, cross over to the other side from the Brentsman's Bridge corridor. So technically, the highway was built to have a cap on it. Like when they did construction two decades ago, that was already thought of, but they never put the caps on. So now, all these years later, the county has applied for $25 million to actually jumpstart this project. But it's not the first time they've applied for this money. It's extremely competitive and also hard to achieve.
Yeah. And so the idea is, you mentioned this sunken highway, Fort Washington Way, that divides downtown and the banks. And the idea behind these caps was really to connect the two a little better, right?
Right, exactly. So if they put, you know, a deck on top of the highway, we could walk on it. Future buildings could be built on it. And therefore, there'd be more density downtown. It would just look more cohesive overall.
Yeah. But as you mentioned, it's expensive. I mean,
right.
What you mentioned, that there's been this application for $25 million in federal funding. What's the latest estimate of how much it would cost to get at least phase one of this done?
About $50 million. That is based on the application that the Inquirer obtained. It was pretty detailed. And that would only cover, like you said, phase one, so a 1.2-acre cap, as well as the design of the rest of the caps, which would be nearly to Main, nearly to Elm Streets, and then also making 2nd and 3rd Streets more pedestrian-friendly, bike-friendly.
Mm-hmm. Where would this first cap be? Help me remember which chunk.
Right. It would be the dead center, so Vine and Walnut.
Okay, yeah. Okay, between Vine and Walnut. This federal grant, you mentioned, it's a $50 million total, so it would need a local match.
Yes.
To get her done. How much, that would be another $25 million, mm-hmm. I assume. Where would that money come from?
Right, that's the big question, right? So in speaking with some sources from the county who put together the application, they said it come from a variety of sources, mostly likely state funding. Which is common, but private fundraising is an option, maybe a levy of some sort, tax increment financing, other grants.
Yeah. Well, I imagine it's expensive because it's kind of complicated. It's not like just paving a sidewalk or something.
Yeah.
You've got traffic going underneath. There has to be, ventilation. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that goes into this, right?
Yes. This is so logistically complicated. I really can't picture it. And even after looking at like technical drawings, I still don't understand. So if it were to happen, we'd all learn a lot as we drive underneath, yeah. For sure.
Or don't drive underneath.
Or don't. Walk yeah. by. Head
right. Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned the county has tried to get federal funding for this project before.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that history?
Yes. So in my time, I've been in Cincinnati 4 years, and they've applied 4 years in a row. This is the fourth. So is the fourth time the charm? The question, we don't know. Again, the folks behind the applications have said that they haven't been successful because they've tried to think too big. So with this application, they've really condensed their idea just to this, you know, one cap and not the whole thing, because that would be more expensive and more complicated. So they're feeling hopeful that this time it will work because it's simpler.
Hmm. If the county does get this money, this $25 million from the federal government, mm-hmm. comes up with a $25 million match, I know that's a couple of ifs with big price tags attached, how quickly could this get built, get started, get finished?
Right. Construction could begin spring 2028. It's really soon. Yeah. And then finish by fall 2029. And that is in tandem with, again, the Companion Bridge being built by the Brent Spence Bridge, also downtown development, maybe some stuff going on at the banks. It's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot. That sounds like a lot of orange barrels or whatever their
redirecting
equivalent is.
Traffic.
Yes, exactly. So, and you mentioned that the idea is that this is the starting point. Is there still hope that eventually more of Fort Washington Way will get capped, that they'll be able to do the whole thing, basically?
I guess the whole thing isn't really doable, mm-hmm. but between the pedestrian / car bridges, so like I said, Main to Elm,
okay,
essentially.
Okay. You mentioned that this is competitive, these grant applications. How much competition is there? I mean, is this just like everybody in the world wants a piece of this money?
I guess not the world, maybe the nation.
The nation, that's fair.
Great
that's
question.
Fair.
That I don't know. It's interesting. This particular application is called a build grant through the Department of Transportation. It's had different names in the past. So Cincinnati has applied for like different infrastructure funding from like the Biden administration. This one's newer, a couple years old. So we shall see like who is interested in it. But clearly we are, and they say we might get it, but it's going to be a few months before we know for sure.
Yeah. Who are the folks locally who are really pushing for this?
As in put together the application?
Right.
Or okay.
Right.
So that would be the folks at the Banks Public Partnership. And Hamilton County is the applicant. The city of Cincinnati has to have some stake in it. And then the chamber, regional chamber
okay.
as well.
Okay. And you said the reason they think this fourth time, at least in 4 years, could be a charm is because they've kind of simplified mm-hmm. things?
That is what I was told. However, there's another element to it, which is that, you know, there's been new visuals released about the future of the banks, which include capping Fort Washington Way and showing this incredible like landscaped parkland on top of the highway. So I think those two things combined, their thinking could set them apart.
I see. To show, hey, this could be part of a bigger,
right.
splashier.
It's a connector.
Yeah.
It's what something people want.
Right, right. When will we find out if indeed this money comes through from the federal government?
So I'm told it will be middle of the summer, but then there might be like another step that the county has to go through to fully get approved, mm-hmm. but we'll know sometime in June or July.
Okay. Well, you're going to have a busy summer, I bet.
I know. There's too much development going on, guys. Let's slow it down.
Yeah. I'm sure all the developers should be really happy that you just said that.
They're not going to slow down. It's fine.
No, they won't.
Call
you're
me.
Right. You're right. Well, this has been great. I have been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer real estate enterprise reporter, Sydney Franklin. Thanks so much for your time today, Sydney.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, tenants sue CMHA as a former property manager is accused of stealing their rent. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Tenants of a Cincinnati Metropolitan Housing Authority complex have filed suit against CMHA as a former property manager is accused of stealing their rent money. Joining me now to explain is WVXU long-form investigative reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, Lucy.
And also in the studio, we have WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. She's going to talk with us about the City of Cincinnati's projected budget deficit. Easy for me to say. Thanks for being here, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Nick, let's start with you. You had an update this week on this lawsuit filed by tenants of a CMHA complex. Where do they live? What are they asking the court to do?
Yeah, so there's a few updates this week on this. So these folks live in a building owned by CMHA called the Evanston, which is in Evanston, but just barely. It's right next to Norwood. It's okay. On Dana and Montgomery, I believe. They are asking the court to tell CMHA to hold off on some lease terminations that they've received because they claim the rent money has been stolen by the former property manager there.
How are they claiming the former property manager did that?
So the story that we've heard thus far from the tenants who are four of the tenants have filed this lawsuit. They say that what they were instructed to do by the property manager, his name's Dion Crockett, is to make out money orders in Dion Crockett's name to pay their rent. The allegation is that then Crockett turned around and pocketed that money.
Yeah. And I would assume that is not a standard way that people would pay their rent. Does that seem unusual to you in the world of the way you've covered these issues in the past?
That is not how you usually pay rent. Okay. Usually it is through an online portal mm-hmm. now. But tenants say because he had been the property manager there for a while or because some of them were new, they trusted what he said.
Sure. Fair enough. So what's happening with that former CMHA property manager?
He was arrested in Kenton County May 23rd. He was extradited yesterday, and then he was arraigned this morning. He's pleaded not guilty to 7 charges related to theft and forgery, and he's currently being held on a $100,000 bond. He'd need to post 10% of that to be released, and he's now in Hamilton County Jail.
What kind of sentence could he face, Nick?
He could face more than 10 years in prison if he's convicted.
Hmm. Well, now, the other piece of this is this lawsuit that these four tenants have filed against CMHA has moved to federal court. Why is that?
Yeah, as I mentioned, these are folks who are asking the court to intercede and keep them from basically being evicted. They say that there are some housing rights laws that are being violated as well as their due process rights. And so it was decided, well, let's move this to federal court because those are kind of federal questions.
Yeah. Has the judge taken any action so far?
Yes. He has told CMHA and sort of its subsidiaries to take no action in terms of filing, you know, evictions or lease terminations on any of the residents at the Evanston until August related to this issue. Now, if someone else is behind on their rent for another reason or whatever, CMHA can go ahead and do that. But in terms of anything related to Crockett's actions, they're not to take any action until August.
Yeah. Has CMHA commented about this former property manager or the lawsuit or any of this?
They have not commented on the lawsuit specifically. They have said that they are investigating Crockett. He obviously no longer works for CMHA.
Right.
But they're also saying, look, we're meeting with the tenants one-on-one. We're trying to figure out what's going on here. They said they've met with like 48 of the 58 tenants that received these lease termination notices. They've cleared up some balances and I think like a handful of cases, maybe about a dozen. And they say they're continuing to work through and try to do the accounting. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a lot of murkiness here because there was some, fraud.
Yeah, yeah. So, Nick, what's next with all this? What's next with Dion Crockett's case? What's next with the lawsuit? What about these tenants who are worried their leases could be terminated? What's next with all of this?
Yeah, so in Crockett's case, there will be kind of like a case management conference, a kind of pre-trial kind of thing next month. We might learn more about kind of what's going on there, maybe a little bit about what his defense might be. And then with the lawsuit, again, no action is going to be taken until August. From CMHA's standpoint, there will be some other sort of pretrial kind of things going on that end in the federal court after that.
I know you will continue to follow that and we'll stay in touch with you. Becca, you're on the hot seat now.
I'm ready.
The city of Cincinnati is facing a deficit in the next budget. How big is it and how does City Manager Cheryl Long want to address it?
So the original projected deficit in the general fund, and to be clear, this is talking about the operating budget, it's separate from the capital budget, was projected to be $29.5 million for this fiscal year. That's more than council has had to deal with in recent years because they've been boosted by federal stimulus. So it is a significant deficit. Now there's two ways to address a deficit. One is to bring in more money and one is to spend less. So part of the way that Cheryl Long wants to address this is to bring in more money. money. They've adjusted the expectations of revenue for the earnings tax, bringing in about $8 million more than originally projected. They're also expecting new revenue from the state. This would be in the form of Medicaid reimbursements for emergency services like ambulance rides. This is something that's been possible for a while, but it requires a lot of initial setup, is my understanding. And so the city has gone through that initial very complicated process to set that up. And we'll start getting revenue for that. That's expected to bring in about $6 million. On the side of cutting expenses, the biggest savings bucket here is a hiring freeze, essentially, is not hiring for positions that are currently vacant. That does not mean layoffs, but it does mean that departments that have vacancies will not be able to fill those positions for at least the time being. The other largest cost savings here is delaying a recruit class for the Cincinnati Fire Department. So instead of being scheduled in summer 2027, which is when it was originally scheduled, it'll be moved to fall 2027. And because the fiscal year is July to June, that puts it in the next fiscal year budget.
How does that line up with City Council's priorities, delaying that recruit class?
Well, it doesn't initially, because council, when they passed their budget priorities motion, and this is basically just a broad outline of what they wanted the city manager to include in the budget, they did explicitly say they didn't want any changes to recruit classes for either police department or the fire department. There are no changes to the police, no proposed changes to the police recruit class schedule. That is largely funded by federal grants anyway, so it's usually separate from deficit discussions. But for the fire department, they had asked for no changes to that. Now, the city manager explains this by saying the decision was made in conjunction with the fire chief and that the fire chief supports this decision. It's supposed to be both an immediate savings because it kind of pushes off the cost of that class until the next fiscal year. But long term, Long says it will also reduce the amount of overtime that the fire department has to spend. So it's projected to make savings in the long run as well. And that's because when recruit classes are done in the summer, she says the folks who are training those new fire recruits, many of them are trying to take vacation in the summer, as many of us do. And so it costs more to do it in the summer. So this would be a permanent change that recruit classes would always be in the fall instead of the summer. Now, as I said, council did not ask for that. They asked for explicitly the opposite of that. This did come up in Budget and Finance Committee on Monday after the budget draft was released. At least one council member, Seth Walsh, expressed frustration, it seemed, or at least some minor opposition. And part of the argument here is a recruit class for the fire department is not as urgent as for the police department because staffing in the police department is a whole crisis and the topic of another day. In the fire department, the budgeted, sworn budgeted officers, the fire department is in pretty good shape. You know, they're not desperate for folks, for police. Councilmember Walsh's point is that recruit or that budgeted sworn number has not been increased in quite some time, and it's his opinion that it should be increased. And so we're looking at the wrong number, if that makes sense, in terms of whether or not we're fully staffed.
I get where he's coming from there. So did the mayor make any changes to the city manager's budget plan? Because if I'm remembering my city government 101 correctly, that's a little foreshadowing. The city manager presents a budget first to the mayor, and the mayor can make changes, and then all that goes to council, right?
That's correct. He did make some changes. The maybe biggest headline item there is he reduced the amount that has been recommended for the Farmer Music Center, which we can talk about in a little bit more detail if you want. Other kind of headline items there, he wants to spend $1 million for Blink. That's the Art and Light Festival scheduled for October this year. It's an every other year festival. The city has provided about that amount of money in the past for that festival. He also wants $1 million for a new disparity study. So this would look at who the city does business with, whether minority-owned businesses and women-owned businesses, et cetera, are fairly represented and how the city spends its money with contractors and things like that. He's also asked for $500,000 for physical public safety improvements at Fountain Square. That's expected to be mostly lighting and cameras, but he says he wants to look at the physical layout of Fountain Square and see if there's ways to redirect where pedestrians go, for example, to make that more safe and easier for the police department to patrol.
You mentioned the Farmer Music Center, and the mayor recommended less money for that than what council had originally talked about. Does that have anything to do with addressing the deficit, though?
It really doesn't. This seems to be an entirely different reason for that decision. If you remember, the mayor didn't seem to be much of a fan of the Farmer Music Center proposal when council first voted on this resolution earlier this year. Council had asked for $8 million for this future Farmer Music Center, but it was contingent on a financial analysis where the city looks at it and says, how much money will it cost? How much are they getting from other sources? Will the project happen with or without city support? It seems like since that vote in March, the city has done some financial analysis, although we don't have an actual copy of it. And the city manager and the mayor indicated that the project does seem like it would go ahead even without city funding. However, so the city manager had proposed, I think like had proposed $6.5 million for the Farmer Music Center. The mayor bumped that down to just $2 million. So that's what's currently being proposed to city council. And that would be a contingent on some guaranteed return on investment in the form of some like tax revenue and maybe some other agreements.
Mm-hmm. You talked about a hiring freeze, but are there any recommended cuts for the mayor's office or city council?
There are budget cuts, but not personnel cuts. So there are no layoffs recommended in any department in this budget. But what the 5.1% cuts, which is what was originally all the general fund departments were asked to estimate, those have been proposed for the mayor's office, city council, the clerk of council. Those are all relatively small budgets compared to these other major budgets, especially like police and fire, which make up so much of the general fund. So there are minor adjustments there. So that could be in the form of, you know, personnel in those departments who in the clerk's office and the mayor's office, at least, are not union represented. They may not get, you know, cost of living increases this fiscal year, for example, but it'll be up to those departments to decide how they manage a cut there.
You just mentioned police and fire. Isn't the city manager proposing more money for police and fire? I mean, walk us through that.
Yeah, there is a for the police department, especially about a 15% increase compared to fiscal year 2026, which is the budget we're currently in. Fire, a little bit of a smaller increase. About 5% compared to fiscal year 26. I'd say 5% is a pretty standard increase year to year if you think about inflation and, the union negotiated wage increases, especially for police and fire. That's a big factor here. There's not much discretion for the city manager and city council to decide on wage increases there because they are union negotiated. But the city manager is recommending additional revenue separate from personnel for the fire department. She's recommending about $1 million to bolster health and cancer screenings for the Cincinnati Fire Department. That's been an issue of some controversy over the last couple of years. Also asking for additional money to support the police department's Drones as First Responders program, about $1 million there. And she's kind of arguing there too that that is a long-term cost savings because the more that drones can respond to situations that are, more quickly than a person can, or in some cases, maybe there doesn't need to be an in-person response and that frees up that officer to do other things.
So if she's proposing more money for those departments, does that mean bigger cuts elsewhere? Or is that why there are these hiring freezes? How do you deal with the deficit when you're proposing more money to your biggest departments?
So yes and no. As I said at the beginning, part of the deficit reduced the need for cuts because of the additional revenue that was not originally expected to come in and over the last few months is now expected to come in. So that additional increase in the earnings tax, for example. Other things like the city pretty recently was awarded a $5 million federal grant to help with recycling cart replacement. So that is a cost, not $5 million. The city wasn't planning to spend that much, but there's a smaller cost that they were expecting to have to spend. Now they don't have to because of the federal grant. So that accounts for some of it. But yes, the question mark here, and council asked this question in committee on Monday, but the answer has not been returned yet, which is where are those vacancies? Are there certain departments where there are more vacancies than others? Mm-hmm. Because those are effective cuts, even though we're not talking about layoffs. So the balance of those is really to be determined.
Mm-hmm. Well, how can the public weigh in on the budget? Is there still time to do that?
There is one last public hearing for City Council. That's on Monday, June 1st at 5:30 in City Council Chambers at City Hall. So you can speak in person or speak virtually. Although if you want to speak virtually, you do need to register in advance on the city website. But after that, that's the last public hearing, but council has, they'll probably pass the budget in mid-June is when they usually do that. So you can also come to a regularly scheduled council meeting or committee meeting over the next couple of weeks to give your input there, or you can also email City Council. We've got information on how to do any of those options at wvxu.org.
Well, Becca, you have just educated us about the city budget. You have a new project to help people understand city government generally. I teased this earlier. Tell us a little bit about City Government 101.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about this. So thank you for indulging me and giving the opportunity to talk about it. So we've launched this newsletter. It's an email newsletter we're calling Cincinnati City Government 101. And it's exactly what you said. It's a way to give people the basics of how city government operates. It can be pretty complicated, especially when we talk about the budget. But I think the more that people understand how things work behind the scenes, the more equipped they are to be involved, to vote, vote and to get involved and tell city council and the mayor and the city manager how they want to see the city operate. So if there are changes you want to see in the city, I think the first step is to better understand how things work now. And then if you want to advocate for change, you're better able to do that. So it's a weekly email. You can start it at any time. You'll still only get one email a week. We started a couple of weeks ago, so we're a few topics in. But if you sign up now, you'll start from the beginning. And we're kind of describing it as, like, if you think about it like a class almost, like you sign up for a class, you can kind of do it on your own time. It takes, I'd say, 5 to 10 minutes to read each email. It's not a huge time commitment. And then after several weeks, you've got a lot more knowledge about something pretty important in your community.
Yeah, you can figure out how to sign up for those emails on WVXU.org. The first issue, if I'm remembering correctly, was explaining Cincinnati's city manager form of government. What's the question you get most often about that from people who are just learning about this form of government for the first time?
That's a good question. I think people don't even know the questions to ask, if that makes sense. I think that's the more common thing. So being a council manager form of government, sometimes it's unclear, like, what is the role of the mayor? What is the role of city council? And what is the role of the city manager? They do all have distinct roles. Some of them are elected. Some of them are appointed. And so it's not a super common thing. I'd say for council, I think people do often wonder or assume that council members represent only specific parts of the city. That's true in many cities in the U.S., but it's not true in Cincinnati. All 9 council members are what we call at large, which means they represent the whole city. So there are no districts or, you know, a representative that way. It didn't always used to be that way, but that's history that Howard Wilkinson has described as well.
Yeah. Well, and I know you also, in one of your pieces, explain how to keep up with city government action and give your opinion. And you wrote that council committees are where the action is. Just briefly, why is that?
Yeah, council committees are where the discussion happens, where debate happens, where amendments to legislation are made, where council members can ask questions and get a better understanding of what they're voting on. All legislation, for the most part, has to go through a committee before it gets to city council. And there are some committees, I'd say the most key committees, like budget, for example, all 9 members of council are on that committee. So we know pretty much what they're going to say and what they think about a particular issue or allocation of funding before it gets to city council. So by the time something appears at a final city council meeting for a final vote, we kind of have an understanding already of how the vote's going to turn out. It's pretty rare for that vote to change between committee and council.
Yeah. Well, check out Cincinnati City Government 101 on our website, wvxu.org. You won't be sorry you do. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and long-form investigative reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.